Hi, good evening, everybody. Well, it's evening where I am. Thanks for tuning in to Moms Fighting Autism. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis. I have a 14-year-old son with autism, and I've been very active in the autism community since he was diagnosed at the age of four. I've served as president of the Autism Society of America Dayton chapter. I've worked as the assistive technology specialist for Goodwill Easter Seals, and I'm a regular contributor to Autism Today. There's two ways to listen to tonight's webinar. You can log in to momsfightingautism.com, and about halfway down the page, you'll see a box that says register for this website. The webinar is completely free. Once you're registered, you'll see a blue box in the upper left-hand corner of the screen, and there you can click listen in and hear the discussion via the internet. You can click ask a question if you'd like to submit a question to our speaker. You can also listen in by phone by calling 949-333-4806 and enter conference ID 168978#. That's 168978#. All callers are immediately muted, so don't worry about background noises. We can't hear you. If you'd like to ask a question live of our speaker tonight, you can press star 2, and that will alert me that you've raised your hand to ask a question. We do try to get to as many of the questions and the common themes as we can in the time we have allotted. When the slideshow begins, Internet users can go to their blue box and see a box that says slides, and that's where you'll click to view the slideshow. It takes a moment to connect. Once the slides are up, you can synchronize the slides with either your phone or the webcast audio by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. Mute your computer if you are listening via phone so you don't get an echo. We have 2 hours allotted for tonight's webinar, so without further ado, let me introduce our speaker. Tonight we welcome Dr. Philip DeMeo. Dr. DeMeo, would you like to give us a little bit of your bio, who you are, what you do?
Oh, of course, Nancy. Thank you. Nancy,
thank you for being here with us tonight.
Of course, and my thanks to Moms Fighting Autism and this wonderful opportunity for us to just come together and talk about the immune system and autism spectrum disorders. As far as my background, I'm a MD, and I've been doing healthcare for about three decades, I guess. And and once my son was diagnosed with autism, our lives changed, my wife and I. And so my little guy, Daniel's 11 and a half years old now. And he continues to improve on biomedical treatment. He still has his challenges, and we are working on him every day. He's a child with a lot of recovery, and he does things that are incredible that I don't think we ever believed he ever would. And I assign that to his mother and to his teachers and his therapists, and a lot of it to the biomedical treatment we do. I think it's some of everything. And he's a child that a lot of these immune system problems do pertain to. As far as myself now, I've really devoted myself full-time to biomedical treatment of the autism spectrum. And I'm sure people out there are very familiar with this concept, but just to get us all on the same page, this means that I believe that the overt symptoms of autism that are behavioral, that manifest as upsets or language disorders or difficulties in social interactions and so on, are symptoms that have a biologic basis of the internal body workings that are not functioning properly. And one of those big workings in the body is the immune system. If things happen where the immune system goes wrong, then you can get things like PANDAS. And if you're not familiar with that, you'll hear about it tonight. It's basically severe OCD, and you'll hear about that too. And it can be very, very disruptive for our children and our families. And there's a lot of things like pain and bowel dysfunction and difficulty growing and thyroid dysfunction and all kinds of things. So the biologic basis, the biomedical concept, is what I practice every day and with thousands and thousands of our patients. I'm in Ohio, and we see patients from all over the world, and we're just privileged and honored to see them. It's a lot of work. It's very challenging, and we work hard to help these kids recover every day. In my spare time, I'm also the executive director and the founder of the American Medical Autism Board, which means if there's a medical basis to autism and OCD and a medical basis to Asperger's and reactive attachment disorder and to oppositional defiance and TDD, and ADHD and so on, that this is a big emerging specialty, and it needs to be one that is under a specialty board. And that doesn't mean I think every doctor has to decide that they want to come under my board, but this is a board that I started as a nonprofit to basically, just like if you wanted to find a specialized pediatrician or a cardiologist or something, you'd want to see what their training, their experience, and if they're board certified. So we're entering a 3-year window now where we're able to begin the board certification process toward the first of the year. And that's what that board is about. I'm very devoted to it. It's something I do as a volunteer situation. And I'm also the chief medical officer of the U.S. Asperger and Autism and Asperger Association. You can see it on the screen there. So to find out more, you can click to any of these things that I've got on the screen. And really, I just think it's a privilege to be here and talk about our kids. It's a big challenge. They're a lot of work, and it's because they have very, very big struggles and challenges every day, and the goal is to help them take joy and enjoy their lives, to be pain-free, to be nourished, and for as many of them as we can, to recover them as much as possible from their cognitive and speech and language and social troubles that are all biologically based. That's what we do.
What was Daniel's diagnosis, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah, my son Daniel, he's our only child. He has severe regressive autism. Daniel was wonderful and growing and blossoming and beautiful little kid that looks just like his mother. He's got red hair and blue eyes. He had 3,000 words by the time he was 14 years old. He was talking in sentences. He was doing a little bit of reading, a little bit of math. He could calculate things up to 3 and sometimes 4. He understood how numbers worked. And then when you counted the stairs, there were 13 of them. I wondered how he knew how to count to 13, because my wife was counting up the stairs, and he understood that that was enumerating each stair. He understood that pictures of things he'd see in abstract children's books really related to an animal, that when the snow melted, he'd see those animals come out of the bushes. I don't know how he figured that out, but he did. And he started to point that stuff out to us, you know, at various seasons. And he got very excited about reading books and things of that nature. Well, between 14 months, where he was with that description, and 18 months, he had been sickly physically. He wasn't mentally sick. He was physically ill up to the 14 months, with lots of feeding and growing problems and sleep issues and abdominal pain and trouble with constipation. But then he got hit with a set of vaccines, and at 18 months, that's when he went down, and we lost him. And we've never seen that same child. We've seen a lot of it come back, and a lot of him come back, as recently as yesterday. So we recently changed some of his yeast biomedical treatment around. He was doing fine with some of the treatments, but it wasn't to my satisfaction, his mother's, or to his probably either. And so we changed it around about 4 weeks ago, and in the 3.5-4 weeks since we did that, his speech is more fluid. He's got more joy and connectedness. His language is better. He's sleeping better, he's happier, and, you know, he's going forward. So at any age, even at 11, 12, 13 years old, and we've had 38-year-olds, and we've had 4-month-olds that have brothers and sisters on the spectrum, and the parents are starting to see some feeding or growth issue or social disconnects and things that are regressive, we have treated people at all ages, and we continue to do so. So Daniel is a wonderful boy that has a great daily life, and we try to help him through that. And my role in that is his father and as a biomedical practitioner.
He's pretty lucky to have a dad as a doctor that specializes in this.
Well, I'll tell you what, Nancy, I can never be good enough, because I think autism is a real challenge. I don't think being a parent for any child is easy. But I'm never ever going to consider myself adequate, because there are times when he'll still have some upsets or some abdominal pain or trouble sleeping or something of that nature. And like I say, lately it's been, I won't call it smooth sailing, but lots and lots better, just with 1 or 2 or 3 little changes in the supplements we use for brain chemistry, for the immune system, and for the yeast was a big one we did recently. And so it's just been lots better. And he still has the hardest job. I said this at Autism One recently, when they had the big gala dinner meeting and all these people were gathering to, you know, talk about each other and things. And I said, you know, as hard as the worst day I have, whether it's parent or doctor or that most challenging day, I wouldn't call any of them bad days, but the challenging days, the children and the family members always have a much harder job. And so someday maybe I'll do everything he needs. And until then, until he's recovered, until he's pain-free, until he's able to go out in the world by himself, I'm not planning on going anywhere. It's, you know, I still have a bar to meet that's out of my reach. So you're very kind, but I look for the day when I'm able to meet every single one of his needs.
Well, you know that we've been doing biomeds with Sam.
Sure, of course.
And kind of, you know, got away from that a little bit, but he's 14, and we're reintroducing B6 and magnesium.
Wonderful. Yeah, right.
Thinking that's going to help to calm, but I really need to get back in, have him tested, and, you know, really get a good view of what's going on instead of just hit or miss here guessing.
Of course, you know, if we have an older or a younger family member, let's take a different disease like a stroke, which is not what Sam or Daniel or really pretty much most of the people listening, although we do have little children who have cerebral palsy or head injuries or something, low oxygen issues, for which we'll talk a little bit about hyperbaric tonight too. And if a person that's an older grandma, or I'm going to stereotype a little bit just to get my point across, if they have a stroke, you know, that's biomedical. Nobody says that their mother's a bad parent and how come they're not talking the same as they did last week, and somebody just needs to buck up and just get their act together and so on and so forth. They get rushed to a hospital, and they should. They get their blood sugar checked, and they should. They get oxygen put on, and they should. They get a CAT scan of their head, and they should. You know, all these things are medical tests and treatments. And then people put them on, heaven forbid, special diets to control their blood pressure with salt and cholesterol with fat and calories and things with sugar and diabetes. And that makes sense because those things are the biomedical basis of their stroke. And then if we fast forward to kids who are in double digits of age, like your son Sam and my son Daniel, the stroke patient still has to keep doing their treatments 4 or 5 years out from their stroke. And if they slip and then things get worse, sometimes they need to regroup and start with the basics and build themselves back into the program that helps them the most. Mm-hmm. And therapy is important for those people, and supportive family and a community that helps lower the barriers that make it hard for a person who's had a stroke. And so I view the autism, I think all of us do, the same way. And the severe ADHD, the horrible anxiety and, you know, various emotional regulatory disorders and oppositional defiance and OCD and so on and so forth. You know, we need all these things. We need the therapists, we need the schools, we need the biomed, we need all of it. And so it's true, when you get overwhelmed or you feel like you've gotten off track, or if I feel like I have or anybody, you kind of do what you do in your car. You steer back to the middle of the lane, you start paying attention to what it is. That's the fundamental basics, you know, kind of check yourself, is your foot on the gas the right way, and then take a breath and then decide about nuances. Then you can turn on the radio and adjust the you know, the air conditioning and the windshield wipers and all those little things. You got to get in the lane again. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, those fundamental things are what's important. And that's where our kids are very, I don't want to say hard to love, but it's a very different kind of love, because it's different when you have a child who has severe diabetes, or a child who's got limb deformities, or who's blind from, you know, something like childhood glaucoma. There's a different way that you add to the love that you give to them, because that's what they need. They need the medical help. And you know, I think parents and caregivers and grandparents and a couple of close people are the ones that usually are able to orchestrate this, you know, better than anyone else.
Well, so, before we get into your presentation, I did want to say that it's comforting to hear you say that you'll never feel like you have done enough.
Never.
Because, you know, I'm out here, I'm not a medical doctor, I'm just a mom, and I'm trying to coordinate all these interventions, and we don't even know what we're dealing with, really. We don't know what's causing it, we don't know what fixes it, and if you have something like diabetes, you kind of understand how to get the blood sugar under control and what to do and what to look for, but autism is just such an uncharted path, we don't know what the heck we're doing anyway. Nobody's an expert.
Yeah, and when that's true, and whenever, that's what I said recently on the U.S. Autism and Asperger Association newsletter, there was a group of experts who did some research about what it means to have another baby if you're a couple who has a child with autism.
Right.
And so that came out, and I made some comments about it, but they didn't talk anything about prevention. And I think that some concepts have come forward where we do that on a daily basis, not because we know everything or that they don't know anything. It's because we all need to bring all the information in. And there's so many things out there. You're right. If there's uncharted water out there, and if we don't chart through it and sail through it to help our kids, nobody will sometimes.
And then there's those that are touting snake oil and, mm-hmm. you know, instant cures and
Right. No, you're right.
So it's unfortunate.
Yeah, there's a lot of things out there that's all, you know, when I look back at what my wife and I, you know, did when we were making decisions about things, we thought we were doing everything. Now we look back, we'd probably do more than that, meaning we heard about other things, biomedical and therapies and things of that nature. We probably would do twice as much and put the pedal to the metal more than we thought, probably through the floor of the car. And there are still people who, you know, we listened to what they said and tried to do what they said it was all ABA or all floor time or all biomed or all diet and all, you know, methyl B12 or all carbohydrates and all yeast. It's part of all of those things, and you have to decide which ones you're going to put your effort, your time, and your resources, frankly. And that happens with all of us, whether you're a physician or not.
Yeah, and some of us run out of resources quickly.
Yeah, we all do. There's just nothing that in this day and age now, even in just the last 3 years, just to raise a neurotypical child and go to the public school and everything is very difficult for most people to afford,
mm-hmm.
unless you're independently wealthy. So if you get hit with autism, whose rates still continue to climb, then it just, I just think you can't do it alone. You know, Hillary Clinton was right to take the village, and that's the issue. There is a little, one of the sites there, if you want to go look at the American Medical Autism Board site, it's ASD Boards, B like boy. I don't think that comes across in that slide clearly like that. So that's just where you can look. You can just Google my name and find things on there, but if you look at the American Medical Autism Board, you'll find out. That's for the public, really, but for doctors who want to know about it, that information is on there. And the U.S. Autism and Asperger Association's newsletter is out now, and you can see that. But, this is an exciting time to talk about the immune system.
It sure is. Do you want to go ahead and get into your slideshow, and we can continue?
Why don't we? And we'll, you know, start again by trying to get ourselves all on the same page. You know, the immune system is just like any other system. It's got its own turf and its own parts of the body, and it's the liquid white blood cells in the bloodstream and the spleen and the liver and the bone marrow and all the lymph nodes, and they all gather together to become the immune system. But what they really are doing is distributing all of their function throughout every single square inch of the body, even the surface of the skin, inside the mouth, the passage in the GI tract where the leaky gut concept, you know, is, and so on, inside the brain itself, where a lot of these issues of PANDAS with, you know, its association with strep and respiratory infections and so on is. Here's the set of major things that we have on this slide for treating kids on the spectrum. And again, remember, the spectrum includes the kids who have OCD and the kids who have PDD, all the A's and all the D's. I've been saying this for the better part of a decade, and the A's and the D's. We've got reactive attachment disorder with the adoptive kids and ADHD and so on. But they all really are in the autism spectrum, and I know different psychologists and school personnel have different definitions of that. But it means there's abnormal behavior, abnormal interactions, difficulties with social things, learning, and it's virtually never mental retardation.
Are they getting ready to change the diagnostic criteria in the DSM-5?
Yeah, they keep changing it, and then some doctors, particularly neurologists, but, you know, they all have their vote in this, have said that it's not a spectrum. That drives them crazy. They don't like that concept. They want to say this kid has attention deficit. This one has PDD-NOS, which is sort of slightly watered-down autism. This one has regressive autism. This one has child disintegrative disorder. When you look at them on paper and look at some of their lab tests and some of the things that most conventional doctors don't think of as part of their developmental problems, like their immune system. You know, I don't think it's a coincidence that we have patients in our practice that have autism and they land in the hospital every 6 weeks with pneumonia that's life-threatening. It's not two different diseases. It's the same disease, and it's manifesting in two different areas. So if we depart again to another disease and we look at diabetes, people can get cataracts from diabetes. They can get strokes. They can have slow emptying to their stomach. They can have kidney failure where they have to go on dialysis. They can have ulcers on their legs and poor circulation. They can get a heart attack. They can certainly have high blood sugar and abnormalities of their urine and so on. Not all diabetics get all that stuff. Some of them get one, some get the other, some get these things at a severe level by age 20. Some of them go 75, 80 years without having these problems, and then they might start to get some of these issues. And so autism spectrum disorders are very similar. And when you look at it biologically from the inside, for reasons we still don't understand, some people have more of persons on the autism spectrum have more of a problem with their immune system. Others have more of a problem with their gastrointestinal function, their absorption of nutrition. Others have difficulty with sensory and processing issues, and they get very overwhelmed if the lights are too bright or if there's too many people in the classroom or if they're not in the front row because they can see everybody out of their peripheral vision and they can't concentrate on what the teacher is saying on, you know, the screen or the blackboard or whatever they're using in school nowadays. And so some kids, it's more severe in one realm than another. So if your car has flat tires, then you'll work on that. Maybe that's the immune system of the car. If your car's got a leak in the gas tank, then maybe you'll work on that. So each person's car can have different problems. So tonight we're going to look at what happens with the immune system. And these are treatments that we have. We have immunoglobulins, and we can give those IV through, you know, into the vein directly or give them orally. And there are other versions of immune factors, colostrum and things of that nature, okay? Mm-hmm. Then there's some of the diabetes drugs that are marketed for diabetes. They're soon to go off the market. One already did. And then there's Actos, which is left for about another month or so, and that's going to be virtually impossible to get in about a month or so. But it's done some wonderful things for some kids, and I still want to talk about it. And then low-dose naltrexone, and we developed the Actos protocol. We modified the IV and oral immunoglobulin protocols. We developed the ultra-low-dose naltrexone protocol. So I'll mention these as we go through. We have enhanced absorption curcuma, which is in the ginger family. So that's one of the natural products that there are. And immunoglobulins are natural products. They're from the healthy blood of people whose immune systems are good. And hyperbaric oxygen doesn't get a vote in this doesn't get put up on the scoreboard for this, but it should be, because many kids' immune systems will not get well until we do hyperbaric oxygen treatment. Some kids don't need hyperbaric oxygen, and some others would not have recovered or become well without it. And there's a variety of other treatments that should not be ignored. So if we go to the next slide, let's see here if I can do this. Now let's talk briefly about Actos, but my point with any of these slides is not for everyone to read through each and every word. I'm not going to, or to memorize these. Nancy's going to make all this, you know, and is making these all available for everybody, mm-hmm. and so you can look at them later. Just for us to learn about what happens in the immune system in kids on the spectrum, adults on the spectrum, and other persons that sort of have some related problems and what we can do about it. So there's a whole set of drugs called glitazones. Actos is one. Avandia is another one. And it turned out that if you picture a diabetic person who has multiple sclerosis, okay, a brain and nerve disorder, you could see how there would be an accidental discovery that they're getting their diabetes treated with the Actos pill, and their MS gets better. And somebody scratched their head, maybe a doctor, maybe a family member, maybe a patient themselves. These are adults now we're talking about in this scenario. And people started to wonder if there was a happy side effect of the Actos to help the immune system, which resulted in better brain and nerve function in these people. And so some doctors put two and two together and said, well, we think there's some autoimmune dysfunction causing MS in some people who have MS, and maybe the Actos is fixing that. So this is how it started with Actos, and then eventually led to use in kids and adults with autism. If you look at any drug that a person takes, most of them go through your whole system. So you might take amoxicillin for a sore throat, but the amoxicillin ends up in your toe. You might take an antibiotic because you stepped on a nail and there's an infection in your toe, but it still goes to your throat. So the glitazones get into all of the actose in these drugs, pancreas, muscle, all these things. That helps blood sugar. They get into the white blood cells. Turns out that this is a happy effect for a lot of people, not everybody, but it turns out that there's potential here. Well, part of the white blood cells are the so-called T lymphocytes, and I know a lot of people know about this, but there's several different groups of these different cells. So you can look at a high school, and they all have students, okay? Those are the white blood cells. Then there's freshmen, sophomores, juniors, seniors. There's the cheerleaders, the chess players. There's a whole bunch of them. There's about 15 of groups, okay, of these white blood cells. Th2 cells are the types of lymphocytes that are sort of a little bit rambunctious, and they try to blast everything in order to kill bad guy germs like staph, but they have too wide of a shot, and sometimes they cause side effects on the playing field, and they hit the battlefield, and then you get potholes like allergy, asthma, rashes, okay, eczema, inflammation, headaches, diarrhea, cramps, fevers that are unnecessary to kill the germs. So when there's too much Th2, and we need a little Th2, but not too much, when there's too much of it, then things get out of hand and you get autoimmunity, the civil war inside of your body, and that's not good. For example, most thyroid disease in the United States, even for kids on the spectrum, and throughout the world pretty much, there's other forms, but is autoimmune. Okay, and some of our kids have terrible allergies. I have one patient who cannot touch anybody's food at school. He's allergic to virtually everything except sweet potatoes and this and that. And there's a couple other things that, you know, he can eat, and now he's eating broader and broader things, so it's not as bad as it used to be. But he's very allergic to things. That's just totally abnormal. The Th2 cells shoot at food when they don't need to. So if we can fix this Th2 thing, then we can help. Okay. Well, what are the symptoms? Okay. Now this is biomedical here. What are the symptoms when you get Th2 dysfunction? Well, it depends on what part of your body you're talking about. So in the brain, where we think and we control ourselves and we listen to people and then process what they said and then respond to it, and in the nerves in our arms and legs, where we feel things come in and we integrate the sensory input and then we process it, if that doesn't work, then we can have problems with that. We can get overwhelmed by sounds that nobody else gets bothered by and hear every little scratching noise in the classroom and get distracted, be unable to learn. In the GI tract, you can have abdominal pain or simply not absorb your food. And you can go down the list here, but the skin is a big deal. I mentioned that. And so there are other disorders, not just autism spectrum. Adults, we mentioned the MS. There's also issues with dementias, things like Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. These things are really on the same list, okay? Rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, right? So we've used Actos and made it available for all these disorders, okay? So what symptoms do you get? And this is a list here. Tics and OCD, PANDAS, which is the psychological and behavioral abnormal kind of neurologic activity in a disorder that occurs after a strep infection and some other germs and viruses. Tics, these uncontrolled arm and leg movements, okay? The brain is a very complicated organ, and most of it is put on hold most of the time. When it's not on hold, it's bursting out with energy, and that's what tics are. It's uncontrolled. Sometimes the uncontrols are shoulder and neck and face muscles. Sometimes they're thoughts and words and sounds and things of that nature. Okay, and we talked about autoimmunity and so on. Reactive attachment disorder, we have a lot of adoptive kids that have autoimmunity and immune dysfunction. And it's written all over them when you do lab tests and the way that they don't handle food properly and have yeast issues and PANDAS and OCD and so on. This is the symptoms you get when you get immune dysfunction. Not the only cause of these symptoms, but many of the kids, it just really adds up. Okay, and lots of the lab tests. Some of the siblings have autism in their lungs. What do they get? They get asthma. And then the kid with asthma who has an autistic brother or sister, the same disease. It's just in different parts of the body. And neither one of them are lucky, but, you know, obviously it's severe to have brain dysfunction. Many of the other patients in the family will have issues like late-onset ADHD when they're 15 or 20, or they'll have severe anxiety and panic attacks after they learn to talk, drive a car, work a job. It's often after they go out into the work world and get a lot more dental work and a bunch of vaccines. It's not the only cause, but it just takes things in a direction for some people, it's not everybody, where that can throw them into this TH2 issue after they learn to talk, and they don't have, you know, they're past that point of regressing, but they're just beside themselves with brain dysfunction. Okay. So Actos takes the TH2 and gives more of this power to the more controlled TH1. And this is a theme that happens with all the treatments we do. Okay. They all come from a different angle. Apoptosis is where the team weeds out the weak players, and the generals run the troops properly, and you can shoot at the staph germs and shoot at the parasites and not at your skin or your lungs, and there's less allergy and eczema and things like that. Okay, we want to improve the GI tract. That's one of the big battlefields here, okay? And this is, you know, things that we have here that we want the intestines and the absorption of these foods to improve, you know, and how they're digested. When you have a battle going on, you can't send out the enzymes and the digestive function. And, you know, the kids don't grow. They get scrawny. Or if there's too much yeast growing because the immune system doesn't let sort of the right germs grow, the probiotics, the good germs, and it's unable to kill off the bad germs. I mean, that's what the GI tract is supposed to do. Your immune system is supposed to clean house without damaging the walls and the floors and the roof. Okay? So there's Actos and Avandia, and they were both, the companies that own them were shooting at each other in the medical journals. If anyone hadn't seen that, it's exactly what was happening. A lot of it came out of Cleveland, my hometown, and then one of the big centers, it wasn't ours, a conventional hospital, was given a lot of funding by one company to shoot at the other company's products. Then the other company shot back, and then the FDA started to black label the products where they give big-time warnings of dangerous side effects. The side effects were for adult diabetic men. Adult diabetic men, heart and kidney problems mostly, of retaining too much fluid, high cholesterol, heart attacks. I would say that these drugs cause you to hold on to liquids and fluids in your body more than your body wants to, and that's a side effect, and it can happen. It happens with every patient. Most of our children have strong hearts and lungs and kidneys, and so we give the Actos and these this category early in the day so that they can have the afternoon to get rid of the excess water, urinate it out, and they won't wet the bed, or they won't wet it as much or any more than they usually do, things like that. Also, it is a drug that's designed to help your metabolism of sugar and protein and calories. That's the original intent of it from the FDA approval. You have to eat with this. If your kid is not doing well, doesn't feel well, if they get so-called die-off where the germs are dying and they get feverish and don't feel like eating that day and they get the Actos, then they're going to get low blood sugar, low blood protein levels, low amino acids, and they can get, just like a diabetic can get a diabetic reaction. We've had some kids where the Actos was being given different than the instructions we wanted them to. And, you know, it's all a matter of communication. We can never, I don't think, ever talk with the parents enough. So it ends up that when they had some issue where the parents thought something was strange and they couldn't figure it out, they called and we put our heads together. And we've seen this in a handful of cases where if the kid was getting the Actos at night and then going to bed, they'd wake up confused in the middle of the night until they got a snack, and it was low sugar and protein in their bloodstream, okay? So we developed a protocol where we built the dose up in small amounts to avoid the water retention and the excess metabolic effects of the calories and all that stuff. There's no target dose, and this is where there's been some departure in the biomedical autism world, that you give everybody above this weight this much and so on. Bottom line is that Actos is going to be very difficult to get. There's going to be special dispensations. Some doctors are going to be able to do it. I don't know if they're going to have anybody in an off-label autism world be able to access this drug. I think it's a great drug. It helps people. It doesn't help everybody. Some kids cannot tolerate it. It's formulated by the company, so it's patented, and there's a little bit of milk and a little bit of lactose in it. For some of our kids, that's a lot, and some kids cannot take it because the packing agents that make up the substance of the pill are difficult for them to tolerate. And I mentioned some of the side effects. A few kids, their immune system wakes up and they get a little fever, and I mean a little. I mean the parents feel that the child and the family can tolerate it for a few days, and they seem to have one little minor cold or ear infection after another that doesn't use antibiotics, and they get over it, and their immune system is waking up, starting to kick out these accumulated germs that it didn't take care of in the beginning. And we've seen this with several kids. My son is one of them. And so I have the two B's, as in boy, up there, the brain and the bowels sometimes. When you're not sure what to do and you can't decide where to start with how to decide if your child is having some kind of a reaction, good or bad, progress, are they going backwards, what are the symptoms? What we look for is the brain and the bowels, okay, right? I mean, that's what it's all about for so many of our kids. So if their behavior, their mood, their sleep, their ability to attend and sit at dinner and school and therapy is going the right direction, if their bowels have some improvement, if their appetite maybe is better or they're starting to gain a little bit of weight or their bowels are not as constipated or they have less abdominal pain, that's great. And so that's what we look for. Well, during the initial function of active in the body, sometimes the immune system wakes up and you get symptoms in that category that are negative if they were to last forever, and they're just transient. And sometimes we make a judicious decision to try to decide if that's going to be temporary. Okay. Some kids cannot tolerate these upheavals. Okay, and I mentioned some of these issues, and we've had a couple kids get some sort of almost like muscle tension that we've only seen that in one child actually, and another child just it was kind of almost like their strength built back up and that was kind of where they were at with that. So you never know with certain medications and so on. Now, the next slide I have here is still about ACTOS, and it can be used in conjunction with other treatments. Again, it's going to be a real challenge to get this in about a month or so. And so and we've even had a few patients where we do the ACTOS on and off because they had an issue with some of these effects or fluid retention and things of that nature. So, you know, we have, there's really only a couple of us in the world, myself and Marvin Boris and his group in Long Island, that have continued to use this. I don't use it for everybody. I think it's a good drug to use, and it's helped a lot of kids. We have some kids who would never have recovered without it. We have others who have recovered without using ACTOS, and most of them have used some other immune treatment. All right, so I'm going to move on to naltrexone, okay? Naltrexone, a very interesting substance. This is a medication that first was started to block the endorphins, which is a strange thing. You wouldn't think that you'd want to do that. So the use for that came out with heroin addiction, and there are several related drugs and forms of this where if a person tried to get high, an adult who was unfortunately addicted to heroin, the heroin wouldn't work because it has to work through the endorphins in the body. Well, that's interesting. What does it have to do with our kids? Well, there's these little pictures I have of puzzle pieces, not in the same concept of the autism puzzle piece, but just the way that the endorphin little proteins in the brain fit into the little R, which is the receptor in the brain, and they turn on things like a key in a lock that is an on switch. Well, the naltrexone can get in there and block that so the E, the endorphin, doesn't work. And the endorphins in the brain help not only your mood and happiness, but they also have a lot to do with development and regulation and OCD in pandas. How is it that endorphins have to do with that? Well, anything we do all day, we do it and we're satisfied. And we're actually, it's sort of a form of satisfaction, happiness. We have our fill, even if it's a task that you think of as very dull at work, you do it, you file this paper in there, you wanted to do that, you were motivated to get that task done, and you're consciously aware of the satisfaction that you completed it. If your endorphins don't work, sometimes you do it again, and you want that fix again and again, and you're not confident that that paper's sitting there, so you go back in the room, and that's where the people get OCD and pandas, and you see them walking back and forth, checking the lock on the house, and they get in and out of the car 100 times before they go to the grocery store. Or the child keeps opening the box, or they can't stand taking a bite of their food because they want to make sure they know where that piece of food is because they're trying to manage and they can't take their mind off of it. endorphins let us be satisfied that we dealt with a thought. And it's not only happiness, it's a clear conviction that we're finished with dealing with something. And when that gets messed up, then we get some of these manifestations. And a lot of times the kids who are just unhappy all day, and some of our kids are excessively elevated in their mood all day, sometimes angry and upset, sometimes almost giddy with unnecessary laughter for no good reason. They have the other extreme of the endorphins. So to some degree, some of these drugs have been used in high dose to moderate some of those symptoms. But how does this connect with the immune system? Well, it turns out that some people with the heroin thing were sick, and their immune systems were sick. And it turns out that if you block the endorphins all day, 100%, 24/7, there's other parts of the body that use endorphins. The white blood cells, remember those T lymphocytes? I said those were going to come back. And they work throughout the whole body, not just in the brain, but in the GI tract and the liver and the blood and all that. And under your skin where rashes are and all that. Endorphins keep them happy in their own immune way. And they keep the TH2s sort of satisfied so they don't go shooting off their mouths all day. And that connects with this little piece of the slide where I have this peptides. That's the fact that the endorphins are a bunch of little proteins. Well, so is gluten and casein. And that's why some of these kids, and which most of our kids, not all of them, most of the kids will respond to some form or another of dietary treatment. A lot of it has to do with endorphins. And so this whole concept of all these things that are trying to tug on the T lymphocytes to tell them what to do and plug into these receptors, this is going on throughout the body with endorphins. And if you don't have the right amount of endorphins and they don't work, then not only does your brain not work right, your white blood cells don't work right. And guess what? Your intestines also use endorphins. That's why people get constipated when they take codeine. The codeine blocks the endorphins, and the endorphins keep your GI tract happy. Less reflux, less constipation, less diarrhea, less pain, less cramps. So if we can keep the endorphins in balance throughout the body, the immune system works better, the brain works better. So naltrexone is not just an immune treatment. It works throughout the body. But it's very tricky because you have to hit the nail on the head just right. And if there isn't a perfect mix of all these other competing factors, sometimes it's very hard. And that's the tricky part of naltrexone. You have to get the right dose. And that's where I'll show you the protocol we developed. There's other diseases, autism spectrum, it's right here, the multiple sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, which is the ALS, those inflammatory bowel diseases like Crohn's disease, okay, HIV, okay, all these here, all right, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, asthma, allergy, some forms of cancer. I'm not saying our kids are going to get these. I'm saying other diseases that our kids don't have. Actos is something. Low-dose naltrexone is something. IV immunoglobulin for a lot of these. So the bottom line is a lot of our kids are very low and dysregulated in endorphins. If we can use naltrexone and hit the right dose somehow to help moderate the ups and the downs, wouldn't that be great? Well, it turns out Dr. Bihari in New York was treating patients with AIDS, basically. He thought somehow, I don't know how he did, because when you talk to him it's not that clear, but he somehow started this treatment. If you give a low dose, maybe you can tease the body into saying, wait, I don't like that, I'm going to make more endorphins. And somehow he was right. And so it turns out that when you block something in the body tries to make an equal and opposite reaction. So when the endorphins come back up to a good level, they can help the white blood cells in the brain and all these diseases that are on the screen to be improved. So fast forward to Ann Brasher, who's one of the founding members of the National Autism Association, also known as Anagram on the Internet. Ann brought this to the attention of Dr. McCandless, who's a grandmother of a young teenager with autism. And so Dr. McCandless and looked over this information, came up with some of these doses here. That instead of 300 milligrams and 50 milligrams, she thought, what if you use 3 milligrams for small kids and medium kids? That's kilograms up there, okay? 45 kilograms would be 90 pounds. And 4.5 milligrams for 24 hours. Well, I thought that was still too big a dose, but I started to use that protocol in the beginning. And we did get a lot of help with some of the kids with their thyroid and their allergies and their brain and their behavior and their sleep and so on. And some of the kids with PANDAS and tics and Tourette's and so on really got better, and we used it on some of the siblings too. There was a lot of overshoot, though. Some of the kids, those doses were still too big, they weren't low enough. So we ran into some issues with this in the beginning, and so we modified this in several ways, okay? Dr. McCandless had already made it into a transdermal because it tastes awful. It's very bitter. It tastes like codeine. It's very, very bitter. So the transdermal was great. And the nice thing about the transdermal for me when I came along was I was able to adjust the dose. Instead of putting a whole gob of cream on and rubbing it on, you put half as much, or get Lee Silsby or one of these pharmacies to make a real skinny syringe so you could push out little tiny amounts onto the skin at one time, little dots that you rub on, okay? And so what we also found was that you can't have all these competing factors changing at the same time. So for many kids, these diets that we want for them, gluten-free, casein-free, soy-free, affect the endorphins. We can't change the endorphins around with five or six things all at once. That's too many light switches in the room. Everybody's turning it on and off at the wrong time, and the lights never are in the right setting. So we ask the kids and the parents not to go off or on any of the diets they're on while we're changing the naltrexone. If they do, we might have to adjust the dose of the naltrexone because some kids are very, very sensitive to this dose, okay? It's funny that Dr. McCandless and Dr. Bihari had more patients than Dr. Kanner. He's the one that, quote-unquote, discovered autism. And, of course, the mainstream psychiatrists, school personnel, insurance companies, they all use his information. But some of the naltrexone information is more scientific. These are among the pharmacies that have been doing this. Coastal actually made the first low-dose naltrexone cream. Lee Silsby does it. Hopewell does it. Wellness, I know, in Alabama does it. You have to have a properly experienced pharmacy. That's where compounding. If you don't know about compounding pharmacies, call one of those places and learn about it and find out somebody at one of those pharmacies will talk to you. That's what we do. We introduce people to compounding pharmacies. We're not in business with them. They're separate entities. But we get the parents familiar with compounding pharmacies. We had new parents today that have not really heard of that. We need these things to be made right, and they have to be exact. Out of all the immune treatments, the naltrexone dose is the most important to hit the nail on the head. The other ones, you can be in a ballpark and get the same effects. Naltrexone, if you're off a little bit, you either get nothing or you get some negative effects, which can be pretty bad if you're not careful and not experienced. So that's where naltrexone has to be done comfortably just right. So we want the bowels, the brain, the immune system to work better, and we also want to avoid side effects in those same areas. Okay? So we found a lot of kids get itching and rashes. There are some kids who are on medication for pain. Some kids who are on clonidine and Intuniv and Guanabens and Tenex. These all work in connection with and overlap with the endorphin receptors. So this whole thing of naltrexone can change this. What if your kid's going to go get surgery and they have dental work and it's scheduled for next Thursday? And they're going to use fentanyl or alfentanil or remifentanil. These are all things that work on the opiate receptors, among other things. So the anesthesiologists are not familiar with this treatment. I just talked to one yesterday, and we went through and talked about what this means and how they're going to do the treatments, and so we don't allow any negative problems to happen with the surgery. And probably the most frequent consult I do with other specialists is anesthesia, you know, for the kids. And I talk to the anesthesiologist or the surgeon. This is a very important example. What about enzymes? You know, we had a speaker at our American Medical Autism Board conference about enzymes. Kristen Selby Gonzalez, one of the most experienced speakers about that in the country, and she talks about those. And I'm very supportive of enzymes. You know, I use enzymes for my son and for our family, and they're very good and so on and so forth. If you break down, enzymes break things down. If you break down the opiate peptides and these endorphins and all these things, it'll change the balance of this whole thing. So you sometimes have to adjust the dose, you know, and so on. Generally, if you're on enzymes already and then you introduce the naltrexone, no problem. If you're on naltrexone already and you don't introduce the enzymes, you might have to adjust the naltrexone dose. Got to do it with an experienced practitioner. So, and then we found some kids that seasonally, long-term, they got the right dose, it worked out, their symptoms were great, their immune system, their sleep, but then it changed from summer to winter. And when you look at, you know, people who don't need special biomedical treatment, their endorphin levels change during the year inside their normal, healthy, neurotypical bodies. So these are the things that basically happen. And naltrexone is a tricky devil. It's not dangerous, it's just tricky as long as you use it right. But there is one side effect that you have to be careful with. The manganese on the doctor's data in Great Plains red blood cell elements is above 0.017, which is the average amount. If it's higher than that, naltrexone is dangerous to use. That's the one time I never use it. I always do a blood manganese count before I ever touch anybody with naltrexone, you know, up to date. And so that's one thing we are very insistent about, okay? Sometimes when the seasonal changes happen, we raise or lower the dose to find the new dose for that season. And then we find lots of people who cannot take even the low doses of 3 and 4 milligrams. And I always found, you'll find that if you look at the chemistry of it, 2 milligrams probably blocks everybody, which is too much. So we start below 2 milligrams. We start with a quarter of that, even lower. We have a whole protocol we developed. And Lee Silsby has it. Hopewell has it. We've got all kinds of ways we do this to make it easy and simple for parents to do it. So we use what we call the ultra-low-dose protocol, which is UDN. You'll hear LDN out there. You'll hear UDN is ours, and that's what we do. I don't own this product. It's not patented. I just offer this out to people once we did our research on it. Let's talk about now immunoglobulins. And these are the antibodies from healthy people's blood and other immune factors, okay? And there are several different forms of these. So if you look at human blood of healthy neurotypical people, they got it going on because their brain is protected from their immune system. Their GI tract is healthy. The good germs are there in good numbers. The bad germs are controlled down to near zero. There's very little inflammation. And we have a happy situation. Well, what if we use those antibodies and draw it out of the blood of people and give it to our kids or other people? It has been done for years and years. The most famous situation is the baby in the bubble where they don't make any antibodies. So antibodies are the drones. They are not cells. They're like almost like little drones that are sent out from the white blood cells to go out and do two things. They kill germs and they get information. They kill germs and they get information. And so what they do when they get information is they send the information like scouts back to the white blood cells at central headquarters, and the white blood cells make different antibodies. Then the second wave of antibodies go out and control the germs, and they control the first set of antibodies so that they don't get out of line, sort of like a round of sergeants kind of going back and forth reporting to the generals. It's not just a no-brainer. The immune system is dynamite, and it wants to kill germs, but you don't want dynamite blowing up in your living room. So in order to keep the house safe and protected, you kill the germs and escort the good germs through the GI tract and the skin and all that, and that's what immunoglobulins do, and that's the same thing as antibodies, just two different names. Well, they've been given IV for a long time, and oral is off-label where we give them by mouth, and sometimes that helps tremendously. It just gives the white blood cells some ammunition. And so white blood cells try to come to the scene of the crime, but when they don't have enough ammo, they can't fight, and they don't get information. Remember, the immune globulins, the antibodies give information. They need that information. So if we give that from a healthy person by mouth or IV, it turns out it's a much bigger deal to give it IV. And it's got to be given slowly over a few hours. We use the Gupta protocol. Really, Dr. Gupta and I and maybe Dr. Rosignol and a couple other people are the ones that continue to use this. We use the Gupta protocol. Others use a different protocol. Dr. Gupta is probably the premier immunologist in the world. We've modified that protocol a little bit. He's modified it a little bit. And we've kind of done some work where we may give it less often after a few months or a year. But the goal of this is to give it in a way that helps the immune system have the right fuel and the right parts to work as a big team. And so many kids with PANDAS, OCD, frequent infections, brain inflammation, which is not that hard a call to make. I saw a child the other day where the parent said he's hot, feels hot. Well, if you put your hand on his forehead, it feels hot, and he's got big veins sticking out on his forehead. His belly feels hot, and he's got big veins on his skin sticking out there. The rest of his body's not hot. That's where all the inflammation is. And when you look at his tests and his behavior, those are the organs that aren't working, the stuff in his belly, his liver, his intestines, his digestion, his stool testing, the yeast testing. And when you look at him clinically with his brain testing and his autism and so on, that's what's not working. So inflammation is the dynamite that gets out of control, and that's the idea behind this. If you look at the second notch down of colostrum, this is a transfer of immunity from the mother cattle or from the mother human or the mother goat or the mammal to the child. And that's the idea of this. So if we take bovine colostrum from cattle and try to get rid of most of the casein, then most kids can tolerate it, and they get GI immunity, which can often affect the whole brain and the entire body. So that's the concept behind these treatments. Some kids do fabulous when you give them, a modestly moderate amount of colostrum, and they never need IV immunoglobulin. Some kids cannot tolerate the colostrum because anything from a cow, even if there's no dairy of casein in it, it's still a cow protein, and it's another type of dairy product. It's not casein. So some kids cannot tolerate it, okay? Then there's these companies that make similar things to colostrum out of egg embryos and chicks and things of that nature, and these things have helped many, many kids. The IV protocols, there are several different types. We use what is a higher dose than most immunologists use. It's lower than some of the other autism treatment centers use, and we believe we get less side effects that way. It is a blood product, so there's one virus that cannot easily be eliminated, and that's Coxsackie. If you're familiar with Coxsackie, it's a GI virus that can go throughout the whole body and affect GI function, make people dizzy, can cause people to get fevers and deliriousness. And the issue is, if you give this product slowly, we have not had a problem since we modified the protocol by giving this slowly and not exceeding what we think is the full dose. And if you want to use more and give a bigger amount, we give it every 3 weeks instead of every month, instead of giving everything all at once. We spread it out, and we haven't had a problem with this virus. So HIV, hepatitis, these things are screened out and dealt with and killed and filtered and inactivated. And so it's much safer than the old products. The old products also had mercury before my time. Well, actually, right when I started, there were a few of them that had mercury. Right then, they were starting to take it out. Okay, and please don't think of IV immunoglobulin as a single treatment that you run to this tree and try to see if that's the place to shade you from the sun, and run to another treatment and try this, try that. It's part of a whole program. You've got to look at yeast. You have to look at nourishing somebody who's iron deficient, if the B vitamins are needed to help burn calories so the brain has enough energy to think and be awake and participate in therapy and so on. It's not in a vacuum. So IV immunoglobulin and oral immunoglobulin, colostrum and so on, can be used with other treatments. Naltrexone, Actos, some of the treatments we're still going to talk about here, the curcumin, or as part of hyperbaric and so on and so forth. They all work together. Most of the kids need their cod liver oils and their B vitamins and their diets and so on with this, too. It's not all or none. Okay, let's see. We want to go. All right, well, what about curcumin? Okay. In the ginger family, for those of you who are SCDers and who are concerned about carbs and root vegetables and so on, ginger, for most people, and the thought of it for most people who are very carb-conscious about making things easily digestible for our kids, is allowable on most of these carb-restrictive diets and these carb-conscious diets for children and adults on the spectrum. Well, in the ginger family is turmeric, which looks like a ginger root that's been spray-painted orange, kind of a rusty color. Well, that color is curcumin, which turns out to be a whole bunch of different pigments that are in the phenol family, okay? They act different than other phenols. You know, in my former life, and I use this every day, I was a chemist. I taught chemistry at a university, and the phenols are all different. There's some that are different, and this is a little different than the salicylates and the bioflavonoids and so on, because it has two heads on it, and it's got a big branch in the middle, and the chemistry of it just makes it different. We get very few phenol reactions with this. So if you take the curcumin from a spice store, usually from India, most of it in the world is from India. We have some listeners tonight from India. They know about this. It started hundreds of years ago as a food preservative. Why? Among other things, is it's a mild detoxifier, and it kills germs. And it helps tissue to prevent itself from imploding and being irritated and breaking down and inflaming and so on and so forth. So those things connect to storage of animal products, and the curcumin was used for that. Well, it turned out that people liked the taste of it. It's a hearty spice. It's got an orange color. It was used for dyes. But the clothing that was dyed never seemed to grow mold, fungus, yeast, okay? At least not as much as other things. And so the curcumin was a good thing. So the idea eventually was that it's good for the GI tract. It's good for the body. It turns out that's true. Most of it that you would get off the rack from a spice store is not absorbed into the body, but it still does good for the GI tract. Well, what if we can make it absorb in the body? Will it do some of those good things throughout the body? Turns out it's a fabulous antioxidant. It's anti-inflammatory, kind of like aspirin without the bleeding and without the stomach upset for most people. It can cause a little bit of that in a very, very small number of people. Out of the hundreds of thousands of doses we've given, we may have had five people who've had a little bit of that issue. And so if we could get it to absorb, we can help the liver, the brain, and the immune system. It turns out that if you sprinkle curcumin on white blood cells, you get this reduction of the Th2, and you start to make the immune system healthier. But that doesn't happen if you just take it by mouth unless it absorbs. So fast forward to some of these enhanced absorption curcumin products out there. There's really a couple of them out there, and I developed the Enhancer product. I do not own this product. I am not part of the patent. I did the work for it gratis. We just did a round of research that's going to come out more and more. I presented some of this at the various conferences where there are immune effects, often calming, not always. Some kids get stimulated and wound up. Many of you who are listening may have tried it and your child got tense and wound up. This happens sometimes. It tends to be the same kids that have problems with sulfur, because Enhancer raises the sulfur levels, the glutathione, the sulfur in the body. But we want to help the GI tract, the metabolism. Turns out you can use curcumin just like you would milk thistle and other things when the liver counts are abnormal, and there's some of the patients who have hepatitis C, for example. Okay, these are things we can use this for. All right, and so we use this for a lot of things, and obviously the main focus of our practice regarding tonight's talk is the autism spectrum and so on. But we want the symptoms of autism to get better, just like we talked with the other immune treatments, okay? A small number of kids get nausea. I would say probably 5, 8% of the kids get wound up and stimulated at some dose, so you stay below that dose. There's a very small number of kids that no matter what dose you give them, they get wound up, tense, bad mood, upset. And the groups of people we found that are most sensitive to tiny doses where they just cannot feel right, their mood is very dysphoric, they're unhappy, it's like a bad trip on LSD, with or without agitation, they just feel beside themselves, are adult women. They just are very, very sensitive to this, probably because they already have a lot of sulfur from their estrogen, and we have some data on that, and so on and so forth. Small number of people get sunburns, very mild, it's easy to deal with. Hats, stay away from high noon, a little bit of sunscreen or whatever you please, long sleeves. There are kids who get itching from the knee down on the side of the shin, very specific, with or without a rash. When you see that, they usually can't tolerate it and they have to stop it. We've had 4 or 5 patients who have that. Sometimes you lower the dose, it goes away. Somewhere in there, the oxalates act up with curcumin. Sue Owens, if you know her, if you don't, Google her. She's the world's expert on oxalates, Susan Costin Owens. She tested this product, and it's low in oxalates, but I think it picks a fight with yeast and causes these upheavals where the oxalates shift in the body. Some kids, you have to be very gentle and ease it in and off and pulse it and so on. Those of you who have dealt with oxalates for yourself or your child know that it can be a bear, and you have to be a little cautious. But I'm giving you the infrequent part of that. Usually these things don't happen. It's very hearty, if not bitter and piney tasting. Some kids just will not take it. Well, the idea of the curcumin is something where my way of implementing this and the protocol I developed is that you don't know where some of these side effects are going to hit people if you give everybody the same dose. That's what got us into this problem in the first place with some conventional medical treatments in the dental and medical world. So we developed a program where we start real low and build up. Sounds familiar with some of the other things we do. And that works best. And some people use 150 milligrams of Enhanza, for example, a day, which is a low dose. Some use 3,600 milligrams. I have a three-year-old on 3,600 milligrams. That's pretty high. I have some adult college students on 75 milligrams a day. So these are the issues with this. Many people have done this on their own. We can also use this for arthritis and pain, inflammation throughout the body. Some of these autoimmune eye and vascular disorders, we've used it for, you know, situations where we make it available for all those things. And many of our kids have some of these. I mean, a lot of the GI problems are autoimmunity of the GI tract. So the Enhanza works while it's being absorbed and also while it's inside the body. Now, there's other curcuma products out there. Enhanza has been tested for, and not only because I insisted on it, for heavy metals, because a lot of things that come out of Asia and some in the United States have heavy metals in them. Heaven forbid we should think we don't have that here either. And so this is totally free of all the heavy metals that have been tested for. And it's not just tested for mercury or lead. It's tested for antimony and aluminum and so on. It's a very, very clean product. It's very consistent. And it's not a phosphorylated product. Some of the products out there, and I'm sure they do some good, I'm not claiming to be an expert about other types. The research we did and the protocol we developed is the non-phosphorylated enhanced absorption curcumin. And so there's overlap with other products out there. I think it's easier to adjust this product. I've tried some other ones. That's just my opinion, and I think that you should make your own decision. Hyperbaric oxygen is a treatment for the whole body, including the immune system. And the thing about hyperbaric is it has a dose. Don't think you can put somebody in the chamber, turn it up to 10 and 4.2, and walk away and do 40 sessions in 4 to 6 weeks, and you're doing it and find out if it works. That's not what to do. We have a protocol where we, the first week or so, we build up to the right dose for the child. That's why those of you who know us, we insist that you get the training through us, even though it's not something that's something we'd frankly rather do, but we would, because there's so many points of frustration with hyperbaric if it's not done right. And just because a car can go 55 miles an hour, you know, in warm weather without windshield wipers doesn't mean that's what you always do. And our kids are different, and so the hyperbaric dose has to be different for each one. And it's true for adults. We treat a lot of adults with hyperbaric situations. Many of them, most of them are autistic, but many of them have OCD issues and some other things. You have to be very careful with hyperbaric with OCD and pandas because it can get worse. The strep germ does not mind air. It lives in the throat, in the sinuses, in the lungs, on the skin, and then some strep variants live in the GI tract. They don't mind air. So oxygen doesn't bother strep germ as much as it does the Clostridium, the Proteus, the viruses, the yeast, the parasites. Sometimes the OCD gets worse, and it's a step in the right direction by killing the other germs, but then you got to do some specific things. Naltrexone, IVIG, colostrum, something, sometimes antibiotics with higher probiotics to help control the strep to get the rest of the benefits of HBOT, because HBOT is very tricky. Well, HBOT helps the GI tract heal. It stabilizes the immune system. White blood cells leave the bloodstream, and they have to hold their breath to go into the tissues like the brain and the liver and areas in the skin, and they need some extra oxygen with a lot of our kids. A lot of our kids do not oxygenate real well, okay? And so white blood cells benefit from hyperbaric oxygen, and they become better and healthier, and then they start to do their job better, just like we talked about. I would mention far infrared sauna, and again, I don't have ownership in any of these companies. I think the best one is Bob Morgan's Heavenly Heat. There are others that people feel they've gotten benefit from. Some in the Dayton area, there's a lady I worked with who has another version of it that she did some tremendous things with her child that with another version of it. But you've got to be careful because it's a detox and a metabolic treatment, and you don't want the wrong kind of wood. It'll off-gas these resins that are toxic to our kids, and they're like plywood. You want solid wood, and so on. If the circulation goes around faster, and if it picks up toxins and delivers more white blood cells and sends more of the antibodies out there into the GI tract, into the brain, and returns waste products and actually causes a stirring and a distribution of the bad guy germs so they don't get to pick where they settle, you can have some improvements. And when you raise the temperature, it's sort of like a good fever to kill off some germs and to stimulate the white blood cells. This is the immune factor that comes into the picture with far infrared sauna. This is dry sauna. This is not the wet saunas. If you go to those big health centers that all the suburbs now seem to want to have, there's the wet sauna with the dripping droplets off the glass door, and then there's the wooden sauna that's all dry in there. The dry one is what we're talking about. We want to intentionally, moderately heat up the brain so the body tries to cool off by acting like it has fever in a way. It's, there's some overlap with that. And this stimulates the immune system in a lot of our kids. So it's not perfect. It's not just a, an immune system treatment. It's not done in a vacuum. Sometimes we'll do this right after hyperbaric. It's a little more affordable, to say the least, than hyperbaric, but they're still expensive. Although, if you contact some of these people like Heavenly Heat and some other people, again, I'm not part of their business. I just think they have a good product for our kids, and I want the kids to succeed, you know, which is why we discuss these kinds of things, okay? So that's all I have to say on the slides, and I'd love to know your comments and what you think, what your experiences are, and what Nancy, you know, would like to have us sort of concentrate on.
All right. Well, I have a few questions here that I've written down as you've gone along.
Yeah, please.
A couple of people have asked why our kids don't seem to get sick. Is it because, and this is my theory, see if I'm right, is it because it's a buildup, they don't know how to, their immune system isn't adept at fighting off these things?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's true. When your child, I pretty much have the same answer that you do. When your child or you or any of us get an immune response to something, whether it's a fever because you caught the cold from the next door neighbor, or you step on a splinter and it's stuck in your toe and it festers and then it gets hot and red right there, that means your immune system's waking up to that, is identifying the problem, and it's got a strong response to it. If you look at people with immune disorder, this isn't anything controversial I'm about to say. If you look at people with immunologic dysfunction at the more severe stages, if I can say it that way, and our kids are not going to die from AIDS, I'm not saying that, but if you look at HIV at the end stages, their immune system doesn't bat an eye when fungus and CMV virus, the virus, and Lyme disease and cancerous cells and so on just run the roost, can do whatever they want. And there's no fever, there isn't a rash, initially there's no pain and inflammation, and then the body gets overwhelmed with these terrible germs, and eventually, whether it's over a few weeks, a month, 3 months, a year, or a few hours, the person is consumed by the infection in the HIV scenario. Well, our kids have a situation where they thankfully don't succumb from these, but everybody at home will get some virus. They'll be in bed throwing up with a fever of 102 for 3-4 days, with or without rashes, sores in the mouth. Oh, little Johnny was such a good boy. He felt warm for a couple hours, and he didn't really want to eat his whole meal that night. And the next day, he's running around. You know, this is your autistic child, let's say, or the kid with OCD or whatever. And they just don't seem to get the same thing. Now, that happens every once in a while with the family, and this kid this time got lucky, and then the next time it's the next kid. But every single time, and there's a big outbreak at school, and when they get a scrape on their hand and so on and so forth, they're just not responding to these germs, and they're accumulating a bunch of sleeping dogs in their bodies. And eventually that's going to lead to brain inflammation, further weakening of the immune system, damage to the lining of the GI tract, leaky gut, poor digestion, and low production of enzymes, reduced antibody distribution. The whole nine yards is going to, we see this trend occur with the kids. And so if that's the kid, the one that never gets sick, that also has significant spectrum problems, behavior, mood, learning disabilities, trouble in school, you know, problem child, whatever you want, whatever category they're superficially, psychiatrically labeled at. Part of their problem as a general concept is, or at least I'm suspect of it, let me put it that way, is that the immune system is abnormal. They've accumulated yeast in their GI tract, viruses throughout their body, something, usually several of those, and that has made the internal workings of the body worse in such a way that they get more overt symptoms of autism and OCD and ADHD and so on and so forth. And that's the idea. If we can fix their immune system, will their problems, the goals that their parents have that they want to fix, will those get better?
Before I get too far ahead here, do you have a slide you could put up with your contact information or your websites on there so those who have questions we don't answer could contact you?
We can, I can furnish that.
Your last slide, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to that. I thought I was...
You want me to take control?
Sure, I thought the last one had something. I don't know. Usually I have something on there. Yeah, I don't, you're right, I'm sorry I don't have numbers there. I mean, yeah, we can, is there a way, Nancy, I could supply it to Mothers Fighting Autism and just...
I put the... Well, sure, but I put the original slide up that had your website on there.
Yeah, yeah. So that should have all that information. We're happy to, you know, obviously be as available as possible about these different things. And we have some of that information there. And then I would also say the American Medical Autism Board, which, again, is a nonprofit, and any purchase of DVDs, all of our talks, if you just Google AMAB, we have the immune talk, we have issues regarding high-dose folinic acid and autoimmune antibodies and Dr. Neubrander's talk. We've got the immune system and improvements with enzymes and proper diet. We've got all those. Those are also available. But the main issue of contact information, I'll make sure that we get that information out to you. Does that help? I mean,
yes.
The drdemio.com and the ASD boards and U.S. Autism, that can help. I think drdemio.com will get you out to all those places. And what you want to do when you go to that is get out of the practice mode of all that if you just want information about those other ways of finding out how to, you know, get whether it's the talks or my commentary about the genetics and causes and prevention and so on. And get into the ASD boards and the usautism.org, and that will get you to those areas like that. And obviously the homepage can get you back to that.
Okay. And when you're talking about the use of antibiotics,
mm-hmm.
and then you mentioned probiotics, higher dose, how would you recommend somebody, because we all know how to take antibiotics. We've all been prescribed antibiotics. Our kids are...
Yeah.
Often on antibiotics for far too long.
Yeah, right. Very true. Yeah, well, antibiotics are a double-edged sword, you know. We avoid them like the plague, but if you have the plague, you need antibiotics. So
mm-hmm.
What do you do? The great thing about antibiotics is there's a tornado going on, and then the Coast Guard comes in and picks you up and saves you, okay? But then once you're 20 miles away, you're still dangling, you know, and you need some help. And at some point, you got to be eased down, and then the tornado's still ripping apart your home. So if you give antibiotics and it temporarily kills strep or reduces that, and you can get some temporary improvement of the PANDAS, where you don't always have to sit down at dinner at 6:30 or else you have a meltdown if it's 6:31. You don't always have to be the third person to shut their bedroom door at night or else you have a meltdown. You don't always have to go to the zoo on Thursdays, you know, because that's what you did last year from your, you know, teacher's expedition for the students and all that. These are the things, you don't always have to wear the red shirt and so on and so forth. These are the things that that antibiotics can help. We have a handful of children who are on chronic antibiotics because nothing else helps as well as that. And many of those kids get IV immunoglobulin and so on. Antibiotics kill germs, and they kill probiotics. They kill Lactobacillus duo, they kill Custom, they kill Therabiotic Complete, you name it. And so what we do is we double or triple the probiotics, and we give them at a different time of day than the antibiotic is being given, in the hopes that that reduces the killing of the good germs antibiotics are going to get in through the bloodstream and get back in through the bile and the entire GI tract, but we try to make up for that. So we try to do that. The other thing about probiotics is many of them, not all of them, but many of them, at least half of them have strep in them. They have Streptococcus thermophilus, which is good for a lot of people. You know, just like casein and gluten is good for a lot of people. That's a healthy part of a good diet for a lot of people. The thermophilus, the strep thermophilus that's in a lot of the good brands of yogurt, it's in a lot of the probiotics that this product, you know, can make people get OCD. It can make it worse, and we're kind of chasing our tail when we do that. So another note on probiotics is to find one like Lactobacillus Duo Custom, some of these other ones that are out there, Bifido Complex, some of these. Again, I have no ownership in any of these and so on and so forth. These are the ones that you want to do. Some of the soil-based organisms, maybe. You got to check with the manufacturers. Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a good guy yeast, has nothing to do with bacteria, and so it goes after strep to some degree, and some of the cousins of strep, staph, clostridium, that kind of thing, they're all interrelated. So these are the things, and Saccharomyces is the only probiotic that's resistant to standard antibiotics, amoxicillin, Zithromax, just about all of them. It doesn't get killed by just about any of the aminoglycosides, which are very rarely used orally, would be an exception. Mm-hmm. Saccharomyces is not a no-brainer. It can cause oxalates to kick up and so on. But this whole concept that you give an antibiotic, you know, now the obstetricians and the pediatricians, they're starting to spurt a little bit of antibiotic and probiotic in the same mixture, and meaning in the same clinical advice they give people. So we generally like 20 to 40 billion probiotic colony counts, and if your probiotic doesn't list how many billions, then it's just not, you know. These little Danon liquid yogurts that are about the size of your fist, that if your child is not casein-free, they have 10 billion, for example, whereas Lactobacillus Duo has 40 billion per capsule, and sometimes it's too strong. Custom is a wimpy probiotic, but it's gentle. So if you use 600 billion, you're kind of getting a gentle bunch of Lilliputians that can make up for what the probiotics do. So there's all kinds of choices out there. And if you can do it on your own or with a mentor parent or by some, I don't want to say trial and error, but just trial and clinical response, great. If you need a practitioner, then you might have to stop in once in a while and check in with that and so on. So
I know someone who was in a horrible cycle of antibiotics, probiotics, yeast fighters.
Mm-hmm.
The antibiotics would cause the yeast flare-up. They would have to go on a yeast fighter.
Yeah.
It's just a horrible cycle.
This is where it's very important, even if you're, quote-unquote, a very, I guess, time-tested parent, we all need to bounce things off of other parents. I think the other parents are the best resource out there.
Mm-hmm.
So especially for the newer parents with the kids that are newly diagnosed, and if your child is 24 years old and you're just getting into biomed, okay, then you need to hear people like, you know, Nancy and others that can kind of see that coming. And sometimes we need to just always, just for the heck of it, for no good reason, pick up the phone and bounce what we're doing with our biomedical doctor off of a friend of ours who has a child with ADHD and we have a child with autism, because they'll have some quick insight to it, and it really enriches the situation most of the time. There's always that fear that you're going to get nervous that they have another idea that's going to topple what you're doing. You know, well, that's, you know, you should never be afraid. Bernadine Healy, I just dedicated the radio program to her. She stood up for our kids with autism. She was the highest ranking government official in public health at the NIH. I mean, the Surgeon General technically is who that is, but she was the first woman head of the NIH. She also was the head of the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. She also was the director of research at the Cleveland Clinic. She's a cardiologist. She did the Women's Health Initiative with Cleveland's own Mary Rose Ocar, who was in Congress at the same time. The two of them basically teamed up in a way to do that. Bernadine Healy just passed away at age 67 of a brain tumor. It's a horrible thing, but she stuck up for kids with autism, saying that we should never be afraid of research. She was talking about the vaccine question and that statement she made, but never be afraid of research or looking into something because we'd be afraid of what answer to get. And so today, for reasons unrelated to autism, I talked to a friend of mine who's a doctor and, you know, still works at the place where I was at, and it just broadened my view of the whole thing that we talked about, this medical topic. And it just was a completely different, I had a completely different plan after I talked to him, and it was, this is what you got to do. So when there are various options out there, antibiotics is a good option, and it helps a lot of people with PANDAS. Even if you don't find strep, and if you don't find strep antibodies, sometimes there are other bacteria, whether they're strep-like, pitans, there's all these names for things. It just means that sometimes the antibiotics help. And we've found that non-strep antibiotics, the Philadelphia population we've treated, for some reason, there seems to be a little more success with some of these so-called gram-negative antibiotics that supposedly don't do anything for strep. But they do in certain settings, and germs rely on each other. They gang up on the immune system. So it's pretty amazing that the body, you know, has one or two things wrong with it, and you can get so many devastating problems. But if we do things and do it right, I'm not against vaccines. I'm not against antibiotics. I'm for the proper use of them and not overuse or underuse, you know. So you bring up a very good point. Antibiotics can do a great thing. If you have three tires on your car because tires are good, you need the probiotics of the fourth tire, and you got to put that on there, too, if you use antibiotics.
Absolutely. You spoke to this a little bit with your Enhanza, but could you speak to over-the-counter versus pharmacy-grade supplements?
Yeah, I mean, the turmeric is a good example. We have an Enhanza is, you know, more expensive than some of the over-the-counter ones that you can get out there for what you might get at the spice store. We had one mom that I came into my little waiting area here in the Columbus office, and I said, oh, hello, how are you doing? You're not here for an appointment, right? I just said, oh, it's nice to see you. Where's, and I won't say the name because it's a very distinctive name. Let's just say John, which is not the boy's name. I said, where's John? And she said, he's right there, sitting down next to you in the chair in the waiting room. John had never done that before. John was reading a book. He was calmly reading the book. He was just matter-of-factly tilting his head, looking down the page with his finger, you know, casually looking at the page right before he turned it to see if there's anything else. He'd never done that. He was always jumping and clapping and bulging his eyes out in over-excitement. And he was a nice boy. He never was violent or anything. He would come up to you, and his nose would be a knife edge away from your nose. He was very skilled at that. And he was 14 years old. He would jump right up to your face, clap his hands in between your nose and his nose, and get the exact space where he could do that. He got calluses on his hands and his feet from jumping and clapping, and was a very, very intense boy, almost like he was looking like he was about to tell you off. But what he was really doing was just being intense, and he couldn't be calm. And she used Enhanza, and he got calm within 3 days at a very small dose. And after about 6 weeks, she just couldn't afford it anymore. She stopped it, and she went and got some other over-the-counter brand. And then, you know, of course, all the worries I have about lead and, you know, cadmium and inconsistent batching, but it worked just fine, totally fine. So to me, you start with, I don't want to say the Cadillac, but you start with something consistent so that you know that if it works, great, and then you can switch to something cheaper or easier to obtain or whatever. If it doesn't work, you know that the one that was consistent and you did the dosing and all that, you don't have to wonder and worry that it was a little bit off. I think that's probably true of most products out there, but there are a lot of great companies. Of course, we all know about, you know, if you've been at this a little while, Kirkman and Thorne and Claire and Allergy Research and Complementary Nutraceuticals and these various companies. But there's some great companies out there. There are, you know, Country Life and Twin Lab and Solgar and so on and so forth. Some of them we help people get those, but some of them people can go get them on their own. And there's some parents will swap, if they haven't opened their vial of whatever it is that they thought they were going to use and it's still fresh, you can swap with them sometimes if it's not expired and all that. So, and some things never expire. Lithium never expires. Potassium never expires, you know, unless it's a liquid form, you got to be careful. But these are the kind of things that are out there. Now, the probiotics, most of the manufacturers do not make them casein-free. They'll say dairy-free. Some of them add casein, And you've got to be very careful. Whereas you look at Claire and Kirkman and, oh, some of the custom products, not all of them, not all the Kirkman products. And there are some companies that are, that say they're casein-free, but they really aren't because they're grown in milk. You've got to be careful with these. Mm-hmm. And, again, at first sometimes it pays to get stuck paying a little more, and then once, you know, you're out at a certain point where you're comfortable and you see some good results, then you can start to try to switch things around and see if you can keep the same improvements. The other thing is that the various products that are out there, there's been some very inexpensive companies that really, when you look at their products, they were great, and then they started to add, you know, things like NutraSweet is a brand name, but, you know, aspartame and grain starches, and the children's products have food coloring, or they're made in a place that cannot be policed, that's far away or something like that, or that has a reputation for contaminating with lead and cadmium or something like that. You've got to be very careful, and don't be shy to call these companies and insist that somebody who knows what they're doing gives you a straight answer to something. We discovered that there was casein in the Culturelle product. Now, Culturelle is a fabulous product. It's a probiotic. It's very potent. It kills strep. It kills clostridium. It kills yeast. It does this. It does that. It's not perfect. Sometimes other probiotics are better, but it's often very good. My son wasn't eating anything. He wouldn't eat anything. He was gluten-free, casein-free, which is all he wanted. And I sprinkled Culturelle, which is, again, I think is for the broad public, is often a good product. And I was using that in the beginning because another practitioner I went to had told me that, somebody who, you know, kind of presents themselves as a biomedical practitioner who's done a lot of good. And so I was going to her in the beginning and so on, and before I got involved with this on my own and was taking my son there. And he jumped across the table and started eating this stuff, and I never saw him eat like that for weeks, and I thought, geez, that's funny. I tasted it. It tasted like cream to me. So I was sure it had casein. The manufacturer did not give me and the distributor a straight answer. We had it tested. It has casein in it. Well, that's not a bad thing. It's just that it wasn't labeled. Same with the Imagine Foods. They had some of those beverages that are grain beverages that you'd think would be gluten-free. They're adding gluten to it. Now they label it. They didn't before. And my friend and somebody who's a patient of ours, that was the problem. They discovered that that's what it was. So you cannot be too suspicious about the contamination in some of these things. And so you've got to be very diligent about it. But that doesn't mean just because you get it from a practitioner or your practitioner recommended that it's not contaminated. We had the antimony that we saw in some of the product and patient's blood testing. We saw antimony there. And so I basically, long and short of it, contacted Doctors Data, and I said, this looks like a lab error to me, and they said, absolutely not. So we pursued it, and we eventually found that antimony was present in one of the zinc preparations a couple years ago. It was huge. It came from a faraway place that was loaded with contamination, and gigantic amounts, 2,000 times the background antimony that you would just get in clean air and water and things like that. And now that company is very clean and does not, they weren't testing for antimony at that point in time. Now they are. You know, so we've all benefited from these things that, you know, we've been lucky enough to be part of, but we've been given a lot of that to a lot of the patients and recommended it. And who knew, you know?
Yeah.
And looking back, we discovered a lot more about antimony toxicity than we ever wanted to know.
Wow. Now, most pediatricians and physicians are not familiar with the DAN protocol. Where can people find their own DAN doctor?
Well, and most doctors out there, pediatricians, family physicians, internists, obstetricians, are good doctors, and they're great for most of the things. And I don't want to call them routine things. They're the things that they deal with and they give special, proper care to all day. But when it comes to autism, the general medical community ain't got it going on. And so there was Bernie Rimland and some other people. And again, I'm going to just be proud of this, that he was from Cleveland, grew up a mile and a half away from my father. They never met. Bernie eventually moved out to California. And in the late 50s, when he and his wife were told that she was the problem causing his son's autism because she was a bad mother, he was a psychologist, and he was incensed by that. So eventually he started the biomedical concept by talking to parents who were convinced such things as vaccines and vitamin deficiencies were the problem for their kids. And several of those parents were in Canada. They had institutionalized adult children who were not children per se at that point. But they tried a few things and got some open-minded psychiatrists to do some things, and he was very open-minded to hear this. So he started an organization with other doctors who were few and far between and a few scientists who believed in the biomedical basis, and that organization was called Defeat Autism Now, or DAN, okay? And then eventually Bernie unfortunately passed away a handful of years ago from prostate cancer, but eventually other people have kind of taken over the organization, and they've decided to disband the organization of Defeat Autism Now. And there's other, great things that they're doing. But that name lingers of a Defeat Autism Now doctor as somebody being aware of the various biomedical concepts and so on. And this is why I started AMAB, the American Medical Autism Board, to make sure that if doctors wanted to, I'm not forcing every doctor, and if people wanted to, and it's not going to be on our website for AMAB till next year because we're starting the board certification process. You really have to give 3 years' notice to practitioners to get up to speed, so if they want to, do this board certification. But the concept of a DAN doctor or an AMAB doctor or a biomedical doctor is that I still think the best source of information is the parents, and I think that you can look on some lists that are out there. Jenny McCarthy has some lists in her book. We don't refer to all those people. We refer to various people, who are out there and back and forth, and they refer to us. But I think the parents need to decide. It's very hard for parents. I think the parents need to decide by talking to other people and getting on the web and going to meetings and the people like yourself, Nancy, and others who have started organizations that are parent support groups, and find the biomedical support groups. And some of them are really hardcore, and they want everybody to do IVIG or everybody to do chelation or everybody to do naltrexone. And if you read through some of that and get some more moderate people in there and find out which doctors they've gone to. Some of them have gone across the country and some of them have gone across town. And some have worked with both, And so there are a lot of people hanging out shingles out there, and a lot of people are on the DAN practitioner list in Jenny's book and some others who may not do the same thing as the next person. And so I think that it's a very consumer-driven situation still. We eventually will post people on our website that have become board certified, not because that means that we think that they know everything, but they will have to meet certain criteria, and they will have to have ways of offering broad treatments. If they offer no immune treatments and no detox treatments and no GI treatments, they ain't going to get board certified.
Do you have that criteria laid out somewhere?
Yeah, it is. It's on the AMAB website. If you go to asdboards.org or just Google AMAB, you'll find that site, and it discusses the concept of, and if you go to, as if you were a practitioner and you go through that, it's really for the public and for parents and children. If you move to a new neighborhood and you're, a dad and you're in the park, and your kids are on the swing and there's another dad sitting there and you say, gee, we're new in town, you shake hands, and you say, well, and where do you guys go to get your cars fixed and where do you go? And then you say, where do you take the kids when, you need something from a doctor? What's the family doctor or the pediatrician? And they'll say, well, we used to go to Dr. So-and-so, and he's smart, but he won't talk to you, and he doesn't take time with you. And we used to go to the other doctor, but his office staff never returns calls. This is a doctor we like because we thought that they're accessible, but they're not, in some place where that's, too far away, which is still a problem for biomedical doctors because there are not many of us out there. And we like the staff, and he takes his time, or she gave us this way to do this at home, and then if we don't have success, we can call her about it, and so on and so forth. So these are the kind of things that you are only going to find out from other parents. And sometimes the way to do it is to see if there's somebody close by that seems to make sense. We try to discuss on our website things that, doesn't mean you should come to us, but things that you should think about and expect when you go to a biomedical doctor. So if you went to a cardiologist and they said they didn't do EKGs, you would probably think that was pretty way out. If you went to a general surgeon, You know, to have a mole taken off and you went back to that person with your 12-year-old kid 3 months later because they had abdominal pain and you asked about appendicitis and they said, we don't do appendix here. That's, you expect a surgeon to do appendectomies if it's necessary. You don't think they should do it for everybody, but it, and not for everybody with abdominal pain, but they should know how to tell if your kid has a need to get their appendix tested and have a decent idea of whether or not they should go get the surgery. You know, because you know that it's bad to let it sit for a while. And if you know more than the doctor does at the surgeon's office, you're going to leave and go to an ER and use that as a last-ditch effort. So, and you should also be able to call the doctor's office, get some idea of what the experience would be like or what kind of things they do. So if you call and say, will you do IVIG on my child? I would say you shouldn't be told yes on the phone. But you should be told, well, we do offer that treatment here. It doesn't mean you have to. Or we can find a doctor who does that. The doctor doesn't do it here, but we know about how to determine whether or not that's something that's necessary, and we make arrangements. Not all the doctors who are going to get board certified will give IV secretin to people. Okay? But they ought to have a way to refer out for people who need things like those IVs, okay? And so who need them, just like an older surgeon might not operate anymore, but if they see your teenager in the office and they think that person needs their appendix taken out, they need to refer out. So these are the questions that you should be able to ask and get some answers to. And the staff members ought to be familiar with it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so this is the type of thing that we think there ought to be some consistency of that, just like you would expect that if you move from California to Dayton, Ohio, if you go to a pediatrician, they ought to know what to tell you if your oldest child is a girl and you wonder what advice they can give you when she's starting to menstruate or get underarm odor or something like that. These are common questions, pediatricians, and they're California and Cleveland and Dayton and Tallahassee, Florida. They all ought to be able to deal with that. They ought to be able to deal with what happens if you try three things for diaper rash and it's cracked and bleeding still and your kid's screaming every time you touch them down there. They ought to be able to help you with that. You know, you would expect them to be able to do that. And if they say, we don't do diaper rashes here, you know, do you think they were nuts? You know, or an obstetrician that does everything but deliver babies, you know, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
It's just a you, so there has to be some competence and comprehensiveness. And that's what AMAB is all about. And originally that was Bernie Rimland's concept of Dan, but there were so few people who were doing Dan. And Dan has an apostrophe after it. There's the Divers Alert Network, and they were threatening to sue Defeat Autism Now if they didn't change their logo and stop, you know, using the DAN signs and all that stuff. And the reason is they both use hyperbaric. Divers who get the bends need hyperbaric. So people got confused, and they would go to the Divers Alert Network when they wanted hyperbaric treatment for autism. And the Divers Alert people got fed up with it, and they called their attorneys, and there was some
I thought the exclamation point was part of the name.
Yeah, it is for the autism world, but now they're spelling it out to Feed Autism Now. And,
wow.
And so AMAB is a certification, and you have to make an application. If the application is accepted, you can take a written test. It says this on the website. If you pass the written test, then you do an oral exam. If you pass that, you're board certified. Then you have to maintain the certification.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very much like other board certifications, and it doesn't mean somebody else, doesn't mean the pediatrician can't do take a mole off in the office, even though they're not a surgeon, okay? But there ought to be, you know, some consistency that if you're a specialist at doing surgery on moles, then, you know, there ought to be some consistency with that, where there's some minimum criteria that are fairly rigorous, basically, is what it amounts to. So parents can get an idea of what's what. And, you know, the practitioners want to know, too. They don't want to, you know, sort of get involved with treating kids with autism biomedically if they don't understand what the extent of it is.
Yeah.
I mean, most doctors can point to residency programs and books by the hundreds for obstetrics, and they get an idea of what it's like before they go into that field, and they get a basic rotation in medical school, and they know what it would be like to be an obstetrician.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't get that kind of training in biomedical autism treatment. There's a mother that posted a response to my commentary on U.S. Autism and Asperger Association there, and she has a son on the spectrum and the daughter in medical school, and the daughter's is avoiding being brainwashed. I can tell from what she's saying in there, you know. And it's very interesting to read that comment. Everybody ought to go read it. And when you look at, there's no exposure to biomedical treatments in medical school, none whatsoever of any kind, for rheumatoid arthritis, for chronic pain, for hair loss, for autism, for GI problems, for fibromyalgia. And that's left a big crater in those areas for all of those things. I mean, we've been treating those for years, and when my son developed the autism, I found, lo and behold, that these kinds of things and my nerdy interest in food poisoning and grain chemistry and toxicology, I was doing that kind of teaching at the university and the Cleveland Clinic, and it all paid off for really our patients, you know. For me to be able to, you know, in a figurative sense, it allowed me to be one step away from understanding things that made sense. That when the parents said, I give this kid tomatoes and he can't sleep all night. Well, most doctors think the parent's crazy if they say that.
Right.
You know, and it's not reflux, and it's not because the seed got stuck in their throat. It's because the phenols maybe made them go nuts, or they have a glutamate reaction or something. And the parents are the ones that ferreted this out. And that gets full circle back to what Bernie Ruhlman did when he started DAN, was to have an avenue where people had some training, some experience, and some interest and belief in the biomedical concept. And they had some rules in the beginning that if the parents reported that they went to the practice and they weren't doing some things that a basic biomedical practitioner ought to do, they would take them off the list. And so they sort of tried to police it in the beginning, and then they decided not to police it. I don't think they wanted liability. I'm not speaking for them.
Right.
But we believe that there ought to be some standard criteria for becoming board certified. So that's what we're doing. So it's not a standard of care. It's a standard for criteria for board certified. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. I'm sorry. So at some point next year, there's going to be a list begun of those who have passed the board certification. And that'll
we're
be going to
start the board certification, like I said, 2.5 years, which is where we're right at 2.5, almost 3 years now, right around there from the original announcement of the board's inception.
Mm-hmm.
So we started the board and an announcement in Austin, Texas, in the fall of 2008. And part of the criteria was about 2 years of experience with a high enough volume of broad treatments in autism spectrum, not just DMG, you know, and you give that to everybody and that's it. You had to do other treatments when they were necessary by your own decision and have enough patients. You couldn't just be, you know, Phil DeMeo's family practice and once a week I'd see a kid with autism and then hang a shingle out that I'm a specialist, you know. So, you know, we've made criteria that there's a certain percentage of practice and hours of time and that they're going to have to present cases to us. We're going to make case presentations, and that's going to be the oral exam.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are the things we're going to do. And it's going to. And some people have said that they wanted to get board certified. They called us and said they wanted to come to the conference and become board certified, and that's not how we operate. We're not just, you don't just come to one conference and then you know it all and you can go back there and start doing brain surgery.
Right.
It's the hardest medicine I've ever done. That doesn't mean other doctors will find it hard. I think they do. But it's very complicated, and it's a very challenging decision, you know. And as you know, the parents pay a lot of this on their own because we do, as parents I have for my son, too, because it's not recognized as conventional treatment and hyperbaric and IV chelation and even the cost of special diets. Finally, the IRS has at least allowed that for a tax deduction. But that doesn't – you have to meet, what, 7.5%, 8% of your gross income before you can start doing that for most people. It's really – unfair for the practitioners and the families. That's why so many people don't want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's. I still think the parents are the best source, and AMAB is not going to be the only source, even once we're completely up and running. I mean, we're operating now. I mean, we're fine. We're putting on conferences for parents, and we're developing the board certification process as we speak. But it's not the only criteria you should use, you know. And so just because a pediatrician is board certified doesn't mean you may like that pediatrician. It's part of what you would think to do when ask the guy in the park on the bench what doctor they take their kids to,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you want to make sure that they're duly trained and experienced.
I do want to remind our listeners that are listening on the phone that you can raise your hand if you had a question you wanted to ask directly. Just press star 2, and that will alert me that you have a question to ask. I'm going to continue on with the questions that have come in through the website while we've been talking. Can you tell me, I know we haven't touched on this, is PANDAS, is that an acronym? Does that stand for something?
Yeah, there's a couple different ones. It's the Psychiatric Abnormal Neurologic Disorder Associated with Strep. There's a couple other ones. But meaning you have behaviors that happen after you get a strep infection, but it's because your immune system shoots at the brain and turns everything on its ear. So Dr. Rammelkamp in Cleveland, again, and this is I didn't do this. He was there before I was ever born. He's the guy in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and all the way through the 1970s, actually, and when he retired, I was just starting medical school then. He was one of our professors. He came up with all the treatments that they quarantined the kids at school. They cultured everybody's throat. They gave them a shot of penicillin and sulfa if they were allergic. Those are the only two antibiotics in those days. Reculture them before they were allowed to go back to school. And that was to prevent heart, kidney, and joint problems, because those were real problems for the kids. And he has a small number of kids that they saw that they got ADHD. He didn't describe it that way. They got OCD. He didn't describe it that way, but he gave the symptoms, a discussion of it, and that they were mostly boys between 7 and 12, and they got worse behavior in school. Their grades dropped. They dropped out of sports. They didn't get along with their families. They became withdrawn. Tics, swearing, grinding their teeth, looking away, squinting their eyes, sneering at everybody. And he thought that was from strep too. And they had cultures, and he said you should treat that with antibiotics too. And so, and they used very low doses of antibiotics in those days. Probably a 30th of 30 milligrams, probably about a little less than 100, a tenth at least of the dose that we use now, so, because there's so much resistance. But the bottom line is he discovered that, and they didn't have any tests for it. Now we have some blood counts for the PANDAS panels and things like that. But he said this was also autoimmune strep disease, not just the heart valves and this and that. So the PANDAS issue has really come to be its own disease. It's the most common complication people get from strep. The heart problem, the kidney problem is still out there, and we see some patients who have that still, along with their PANDAS. And they should also, always be. That's why, again, specializing in biomedical autism treatment, the doctor may not do treatment for that, but they'll know to refer to a pediatric cardiologist or a pediatric kidney specialist. That's what we do in our office.
Do you just routinely test kids for PANDAS, or do you look for certain symptoms?
Well, the PANDAS is, I think it's kind of a blend. We do just what you said. We look for symptoms. So we'll get the autistic child who does not have OCD, does not have the PANDAS repetitive, compulsive, impulsive symptoms, and they may not be as much of a responder to strep-free probiotics and immune treatments, okay, as the next kid from the behavior standpoint. But then you get the child who constantly is going up to my computer in my office and can't keep away from it, and they wonder if there's a spot that starts with R on a website somewhere because they're obsessed with the letter R.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't get it out of their mind. They ask me if I have red clothes because that begins with the letter R. They want to know what my kid's name is because mine start with the letter R. Do I know any people named Robert? I mean, then that's a kid with PANDAS that you wonder. And then if the mother tells me he's had 6 strep infections in a year and a half, and they keep doing antibiotics, and every time they do a culture, that's the kid that you do the antibody testing, and you'll do all the different treatments until they get better if you can, judiciously. But then a lot of the kids who have autism will test positive for these blood counts that show the same as the PANDAS children, even though they don't have the OCD, and we often will treat them, and their autism can get improved. So an ADHD and over-focus and the rigid upsets when the kids have to make transitions, a lot of these are really in the OCD PANDAS category.
Mm-hmm.
So we ask the symptoms, and we do blood counts and cultures. And a lot of times the only place the strep term culture shows up is in the stool test. And you'll get strep, group G is in green, which is not the strep throat germ, but it can cause PANDAS. You'll get enterococcus, which is a strep germ. And even though some people think that can have some mild good effects, It's a strep germ. A lot of our kids don't deal with it properly. So we do a lot of testing for strep. It's one of the worst germs for primates and humans and cattle. And that's one of the reasons I think the bovine colostrum helps a lot of kids, because the cattle try to develop immunity to the strep germ too. So, you know, these are, yeah, it's tricky to do. And you're right, we look at the symptoms and we do tests.
So hypothetically, you've got this child and you've done all the testing on and you know what supplements to prescribe. What do you do for the child who can't swallow pills?
Well, there are some things that do not need to be taken by mouth, and there are shots and inhaled versions and nasal sprays. So, for example, oxytocin is the pituitary hormone that people hear about when they get labor-induced under the brand name Pitocin. Oxytocin is a nasal spray or a cream, and it can sometimes help the unusual, unacceptable social impulsive behaviors that people who have PANDAS have. So it doesn't kill strep germs. It's not an immunologic treatment, but it sure makes the patient and everybody else more comfortable when it works. Mm-hmm. So we'll sometimes do that. That's a nasal spray. Then you'll have things such as the immune treatments. Well, naltrexone is a cream, okay? Actos can be crushed and made into a cream by the compounding pharmacist. Lee Silsby does that kind of thing. And so there are ways we can do that. The curcumins have not worked well in a cream. That's when I got involved, because they asked me to help because they were too strong. So there are some things that have to be taken by mouth. Probiotics have to be taken by mouth. I mean, there's really no... There's some spray versions of those, but pills and capsules aren't the only ways things are taken by mouth. Some things are not heat stable, some are, and you can mix them into foods and cook them and this and that. The kids sometimes will be able to learn how to swallow capsules, and I think it's always worth a try when the time is right to try. I don't believe in sticking them up against these high back chairs and forcing them to swallow capsules, because that they can choke, and I don't think that works. If it does, it doesn't work any better than just showing them a capsule, empty capsule that you emptied out, cut the sharp blunt edges of it off so that the round edges come together more like a ball, and start with little capsules with nothing in them, so if they bite on them, they won't get a bad taste in their mouth. And the bottom line is, lots of kids will learn how to swallow capsules. Not all of them. Some adults don't swallow capsules. Mm-hmm. So it's worth asking the speech therapist, and sometimes they don't want to do it, and ask them, tell them that they have the skills, you have the confidence in them, and that, frankly, it's their job to help you with the oral and swallowing and throat issues, and they can do it. And they usually do a good job of it, and some of them specialize in that, and some say they don't. But they're the ones that can help, and it's hard for the parents to shove that in and so on. And a lot of the kids will. We gave our son a feeding tube for a year and a half until he learned to swallow capsules, because we believed in the biomed so much, and he got significantly better during that time, and he wouldn't. The surgeon couldn't believe him when he saw him on follow-up. He called the surgeon by name and said hello to him and thanked him and, you know, all that stuff. And he wasn't able to do that at first, you know, so. And we were able to get cod liver oil and, you know, and smelly, you know, glutathione liposomal into him and all this other stuff we wanted to, you know, B vitamins, you know. He wouldn't take stuff by mouth, you know, I mean, it was hard. So some kids just can't, though, and they are very tough. So zinc and magnesium come in transdermals. If they can't take their chelators oral, there's transdermal and IV. There's even rectal. So for most things, we have an option, but some things have to be taken by mouth. So it's tricky, and it takes a lot of work and patience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I told you it would go quickly, and it has.
It sure did, yeah.
I know that there's quite a few topics we didn't get to, and if people wanted to contact you with questions, how could they do so?
Well, I would, if it's me directly, they can go to drdemio.com, mm-hmm. and my staff and I respond to there's an info@ sort of avenue there, and the number at the offices also, if people have questions about what we do and so on, or if they want to leave a message or something. We often get some, you know, quick calls with a targeted question about something. You know, obviously we can't give care over the phone, but we're very willing to try to give people ideas of what they can do, or if they want to know a practitioner who's in California or New Jersey or Philadelphia or something that we refer to, we're very happy to tell them about the people we refer to. So in Cleveland, that's the 216 area code, and that's 901-0441, which again is on the drdemio.com website. And in Columbus area is the 614 area code, which is 436-2036.
So the three websites you have here on the slide is drdemio.com, drdemio.com.
And the other one is ASD Boards, ASDBOARDS.org. And then the other one is usautism.org.
Okay.
Those are places to get information for people, and those are good places to go. And if you want to listen to any of the radio programs, mine and others, you can go to Autism One on the Internet. It's easy to find that. And I...